Finland's leaders announced support for joining NATO.
We are convinced that Finland would bring added value to NATO.
Plus, U.S. President Joe Biden calls for America's farmers to help make up the difference from the harvest lost in Ukraine.
The brutal war launched on Ukrainian soil has prevented Ukrainian farmers from planting next year's crop and next year's harvest.
And later in the program, how the war in Ukraine raises concern about the fate of arms control treaties between Moscow and Washington. Today is Thursday, May 12th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Herman, in for Steve Miller. The President and Prime Minister of Finland, Sauli Niinistö and Sanna Marin, on Thursday announced their support for Helsinki joining NATO. The country's parliament will debate the matter next week, but approval is expected. Finland's Foreign Minister, Pekka Haavisto, in an address to the European Parliament, said the war started by Russia jeopardizes the security and stability of the whole of Europe, and Finland has assets that can contribute to the alliance's collective defense.
We are convinced that Finland would bring added value to NATO. Our wartime strength of the defense forces is 280,000 troops, and the trained reserve is 900,000 men and women. Finland has many high-end capabilities, including a fighter jet fleet of F-80s, gradually to be replaced by recently ordered 64 F-35 jet fighters.
Finland shares a 1,300-kilometer border with Russia and has enjoyed peaceful relations with its eastern neighbor since World War II. The border would become by far the largest frontier between NATO and Russia at a time of high tension. Henry Ridgewell reports from the Finnish city of Lappeenranta, close to the border.
In November 1939, Soviet forces invaded Finland, the so-called Winter War. Despite vastly outnumbering the Finnish defenders, the Soviets suffered heavy losses. Finnish troops were highly skilled in fighting among the frozen forests, and their resistance is widely fated. 94-year-old war veteran Tapio Niemi still lives close to the Russian border, where the battles raged some 80 years ago. He recalls the day of the invasion. It was a really scary situation for a little boy, Niemi said. I was 12 and at school when the teacher came to the classroom and told us that a war started between Finland and Russia and the school will be closed from now on. 5 years later, Niemi joined the army, serving on the home front during the so-called Second Soviet-Finnish War. His tasks included carrying the bodies of comrades killed in action. Even though Finland resisted Soviet occupation, it was forced to concede the region of Karelia, around 10% of its territory, to Russia. 99-year-old Unto Hakuli fought on the front line from 1942 to 1944. He said the secret was that we were probably a little bit more competent than the Russians. After the war, Finland and Russia lived in relative peace. The veterans frequently visited battle sites across the border. When the war in Ukraine started, Hakuli said, our opinion about the Russians changed totally, especially how cruel the Russians are towards Ukrainians. And it also affects Finland when we consider whether or not to join NATO. I would definitely think of joining if they asked my opinion. It gives us a lot more safety and guarantees it. Fellow veteran Tapio Niemi said joining NATO would give us broader shoulders regarding our security. There are many different opinions about it, and Russia, of course, disapproves that its neighbours would join. Still, when we look at other Baltic states and, for example, Poland, they have not suffered any harm because they belong to NATO. Around 4,000 veterans of Finland's war with Russia are still alive. The sacrifice of those who died defending their homeland is honoured on Veterans Day, the 27th of April. This year, the ceremonies had added resonance as Finland prepares to abandon its neutrality to join NATO in response to Russia's aggression. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Taipalsari, Finland.
Russia is referring to Finland's bid to join NATO as a hostile move that definitely poses a threat to its security. The foreign ministry in Moscow says Russia will need to take retaliatory steps, including of a military nature. Helsinki must be aware of the responsibility and consequences of such a move, warns the foreign ministry. Ukraine's military says it has pushed back Russian forces in a counterattack north of the country's second-largest city of Kharkiv that could signal a shift in the war's momentum. Russia, meanwhile, claims its forces blew up a pair of ammunition depots in the Cherniv region, destroyed a Ukrainian air defense missile system in the Kharkiv region, and a radar station near Odessa. VOA has not been able to independently confirm these reports. Russian forces have been launching continuous artillery attacks on targets in southeastern Ukraine, continuing their push toward Odessa and other parts of the region. Jan Bosha reports for VOA from Zaporizhia in southern Ukraine.
Russian fighter jets fly low here. He fires flares to deceive the anti-aircraft defense before attacking the Ukrainian positions. On the ground, the result is destruction. There is hardly anyone left in these small villages here in Donbas, eastern Ukraine. They look like ghost towns now. Only the soldiers are here, hiding. Everything seems calm when the bombs aren't falling. Everything looks peaceful. But it's just appearance. It is in places like this that the Ukrainian war is being fought. Igor lives in Kamyansky, the last Ukrainian-dominated position south of Zaporizhia in southern Ukraine. Once in Ukrainian hands, this small town went under Russian control and a month ago returned to the Ukrainian soldiers. Igor says he has nowhere to go, no friends or family. He says he prefers to stay here.
Health conditions no longer allow us to run to the bomb shelter all the time, you know. Those who have left, some of them have heart problems. My wife, for instance, has problems with her legs. Those who bring us food spread it around. And here we are, just two of us left on the street.
He lives with his wife, Irina, and their dogs, who are increasingly frightened by the constant explosions. Irina says they have been living in this shelter for almost 3 months.
How do we live here? During the shelling, we come down. That's how we live. The third month of the war is already underway, and the third month of shelling. We go out, of course, as long as there is no shelling. But we are sleeping in the basement, because at night it is not clear when they will start fire, and to run down here from home is always a risk for our lives.
The soldiers hide in trenches not far from here, in an eternal wait. Machines dig up the land that should be producing wheat. When not being bombed, bored soldiers are constantly watching for possible enemy movement. Here in the Donbas region, they enjoy the spring sun and play at being farmers by planting onions in the trenches. In this artillery war, the trenches are the homes of these soldiers. Here they eat, here they sleep, and here they often also die. This soldier says that a colleague is buried here, or what is left of him. A Russian missile hit him directly. Spring has brought back the colors to this region of Ukraine. Green and yellow are everywhere. When the artillery is not very active, walking along a road like this might even seem like something peaceful. But soon, the holes in the ground, the unexploded missiles, and the destroyed cars remind us that war is being fought right here. Yebuesha for VOA News, Zaporizhia, Ukraine.
listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Herman. President Joe Biden visited a 325-hectare family farm in the state of Illinois on Wednesday, praising American farmers as the most productive and efficient in the world. The trip was intended to highlight the Russian war on Ukraine, cutting off critical sources of food that many nations depend on. Biden noted that until the Russian invasion, Ukraine was the largest producer of wheat, corn, and cooking oil.
Ukraine says they have 20 million tons of grain in their silos right now. 20 million tons. And guess what? If those tons don't get to market, an awful lot of people in Africa are going to starve to death because they are the sole supplier of a number of African countries. Somalia, I won't go through them all. But the point is this, that because of what the Russians are doing in the Black Sea, Putin has warships, battleships, preventing the access to Ukrainian ports to get this grain out, to get this wheat out.
The president also said the war is going to have an impact on future harvests in both Ukraine and Russia.
The brutal war launched on Ukrainian soil has prevented Ukrainian farmers from planting next year's crop and next year's harvest. And they're not doing too darn well in Russia either. Russia's the second largest producer. But we're doing something about it. And our farmers are helping on both fronts, reducing the food cost of price of food at home and expanding production and feeding the world in need.
Biden's administration, in conjunction with the president's Illinois farm visit, announced actions to help American farmers boost food production and lower food prices, including a doubling of funding for domestic fertilizer production and expanding insurance for planting a second crop on the same land in the same year. To gauge the reaction among the Midwestern U.S. agricultural sector to this, we're joined by the Illinois Farm Bureau's National Legislation and Policy Development Director, Adam Nielsen. Adam, good to have you.
Thank you.
Are these announcements going to accomplish what the administration intends in terms of boosting production and lowering prices, do you think?
I guess that remains to be seen. I'm optimistic that we'll see some impact. Farmers who are not planning to double crop don't just decide in the middle of the season to double crop. So question whether that is going to have a heck of a lot of impact. The input costs are pretty high right now, so it may not even pencil out. On the other side of the equation, the president wants to create and had already announced a program to increase domestic fertilizer production. A lot of the fertilizer that's used by farmers here in Illinois comes from overseas, so a domestic supply of fertilizer is greatly welcomed. I don't know how quickly, again, they'll be able to get that production up and operating. And one of the things that we have noted, too, is there seems to be a shortage of storage facilities out in the country. It would really help if this plan had some allowance for additional storage in addition to additional production. But again, it's a first step, and we appreciate the effort, and people are being creative, trying to, squeeze some more production out of America's farmers.
If they've got the time, land, and money, what else would farmers in Illinois and the rest of the Midwest be able to do in response to the loss of these crops from Ukraine and Russia?
We have quite a bit of corn and soybean production in Illinois. There are parts of our state where, it's kind of in the culture to grow wheat, and the conditions lend themselves for that. But if you're in a corn-soybean rotation, you're typically not going to all of a sudden decide during the season to grow wheat in most cases. Now, there may be some people who will take advantage of this, and if they do, that will have an impact. But I don't know that we're going to see extraordinary increases in production with these measures. We greatly appreciate the attention to fertilizer production. I think that's very helpful, but it is questionable how much additional production we're going to see as a result of this.
We saw food prices spike during the pandemic, and now with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, while this is obviously not good news for consumers, aren't the higher prices actually welcomed by farmers?
Farmers get just a very small portion of the food dollar. It is like maybe a tiny fraction of the food dollar ends up in the farmer's pocketbook. So I think there has been a kind of a mischaracterization of what farmers' share of my grocery store bill is. It's never been very high. It's always been pennies on the dollar, and I don't see that changing much.
That's Adam Nielsen of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Thank you for your insight for our audience on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Joining us now on Flashpoint Ukraine is Ira Joseph, who oversees Platts Generating Fuels and Electricity Pricing. He's also an adjunct senior research scholar at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy. Ira, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
There has been quite a bit of concern about the war in Ukraine causing all sorts of turmoil for energy supplies, especially in Europe, which is considering a ban on Russian oil. But we did see this week natural gas prices in Europe slip to their lowest level in 3 weeks. Should the continent breathe a small sigh of relief, Ira?
A small sigh of relief, yes, but this is far from over. The persistence of the war and the risk premium associated with that gas prices is going to continue. What's interesting is that we have had a bit of a split between continental gas prices, which are represented by TTF in the Netherlands, and UK prices, which are considerably lower now, because there is some constraints in taking surplus gas that's in the UK to the continent. So that's one interesting feature that has just emerged in the past few days.
You are also concerned, I know, about an energy supply shock in Asia when the Northern Hemisphere experiences its next winter. What signals are you seeing there?
The signals that I'm seeing really are sort of related to storage. You can fill storage as much as you want in Europe, but at the end of the day, the marginal cubic meter of gas still has to be imported into Europe next winter. And the same is true for Asia. So you're going to get into a position no matter what next winter where Europe and Asia is going to be competing for the marginal cubic meter of gas. Sure, there'll be slightly less pressure if European storage is higher than it was this year on year higher. But at the end of the day, we run into the same type of issue if Russian pipeline exports are lower and there's constraints in the system.
Here in the United States, President Biden, who blames all this on Russian President Putin, has acknowledged that the average cost of a barrel has been steady for weeks, but gasoline prices in the United States keep increasing. What are you seeing with energy costs in the United States overall?
Well, certainly for natural gas, prices have gone higher. They haven't gone nearly as high as they have in Europe, but we have gone with the benchmark Henry Hub prices has climbed from kind of a, you know, $2 to $4 range that where it's been for many, many, many years up into sort of a $7 to $8 range. That's been caused by several factors. One is U.S. production, gas production has not recovered at a strong rate as we had expected from the beginning of the COVID time up until now. At the same time, though, U.S. LNG exports, you take the gas, you turn it into LNG, you export it overseas, that has risen. Also, the retirement of certain types of power generation, such as coal power generation in the U.S., has made the U.S. more reliant on gas-fired generation in terms of U.S. demand. So on the whole, we've seen stronger U.S. natural gas demand. We've seen recovery in U.S. natural gas production, but not necessarily to the level that would keep prices lower. And as a result, storage levels, natural gas storage levels in the U.S. are relatively low. The key is really that U.S. gas production has not really increased to the amount that it would need to keep prices lower.
Ira Joseph with the Center on Global Energy Policy and Platts Analytics. Thank you for your insight today on VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine.
You're welcome. Thank you.
The Russian invasion of Ukraine has had a number of consequences. One of them is placing into a deep freeze any immediate progress on arms control talks between Washington and Moscow. This is of particular concern to many people, including Daryl Kimball, the executive director of the Arms Control Association. He joins us now on Flashpoint Ukraine. Daryl, it was just back in December that the Russian government had sent the United States and NATO a proposal on security guarantees. Was there anything contained in it that would have been the basis for serious discussion?
Well, it is tragic that the Russian assault on Ukraine has derailed the talks that were just getting underway between the United States and Russia on strategic stability. These were preliminary discussions on possible follow-on agreements to further reduce the two countries' still massive nuclear arsenals, particularly their long-range strategic arsenals. And while there are huge gaps between the positions of the United States and NATO and Russia on the issues that were on the table, there were some clear areas where I think compromise and agreements were possible. But I think in the long run, we need to understand that Russia's violent assault on Ukraine is not an excuse for indefinitely delaying the necessary work that's in the United States' interest, Russia's interest, international interest to reduce nuclear dangers. If anything, the war and Putin's nuclear threats have only highlighted the dangers that we face as a result of these deadly arsenals.
Now, the only remaining treaty limiting U.S. and Russian nuclear arsenals expires in 4 years. Do you have any optimism that there could be negotiations before that deadline on a replacement arrangement?
Well, in fact, it will expire in less than 4 years. To be exact, it's February 5, 2026. In negotiating terms, there's very little time to negotiate a follow-on agreement to replace the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, which verifiably caps the U.S. and Russian strategic arsenals to no more than 1,550 deployed warheads. I'm not very optimistic at this point, but it is clearly in the interest of both countries to maintain common sense guardrails on their nuclear relationship. This could turn into an unconstrained arms race if we don't have some sort of arrangements to continue to cap the arsenals. It is possible, I think, even without a new treaty that would have to be negotiated, possibly reviewed by the Duma and the Senate, that there could be an arrangement, a unilateral reciprocal arrangement, as it's called, by each country not to exceed the central limits of the treaty even after it expires. But that is a last-ditch option. I think both countries also continue to support New START. They continue to comply with the agreement, exchange the information the treaty requires them to exchange about their arsenals. But time is running short, and I think it's important for the two presidents to, even as the war goes on, to find a way to get their negotiators to sit down to address these issues.
And finally, Darryl, what is your interpretation of Russian President Putin's recent threats to use nuclear weapons in this current conflict?
It's extremely disconcerting, but what I think is clear, if we look at Putin's statements and throw out the less precise statements from some of his deputies and especially the Russian media, that the intention of his warnings about potential nuclear use is to try to keep NATO forces and U.S. forces out of the conflict in Ukraine. The United States also seems to understand that very well. President Biden and NATO Secretary General Stoltenberg have made it clear they don't intend to have U.S. or NATO forces directly involved. So he's drawing a red line, but those kinds of threats that he's made at the beginning of the invasion and up until very recently, I mean, these are unprecedented threats of nuclear use in the post-Cold War age. It raises the temperature, it creates the potential for miscalculation, and it's very important that Putin stop these threats. The war is already dangerous enough. We cannot afford to see this escalate, let alone to the nuclear level.
Darryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association in Washington, thank you for your comments here on Flashpoint Ukraine on the Voice of America. That's it for today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on our social media platforms, just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Chief National Correspondent, Steve Herman. Have a good evening.
This is the voice of America, Washington, D.C.